Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan. This is going to be a very good show. Got a very interesting guest. I'll tell you a little bit more about him in a couple of minutes. The next time I'll be doing a conference, folks, will be in Florida, in Tampa, where I've done a few conferences over the years. And it's going to be the Adlerian Society of Florida. And it's going to start on that weekend of the very last week of February going into March of 2014. They've started to get stuff up on the web about it, but I think it's going to take a while to get all this stuff up properly. But I'm going to be there, and I'm going to be making a big contribution. We're co-sponsoring. The Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy is co-sponsoring the conference. So I had a choice in who's going to be there, and I'll be there. What more could you want? February 28th, maybe on the 27th, that weekend, in Safety Harbor. And check my website in the upcoming weeks, and you can Google them to see what's happening. My guest today is William P. Ryan, Ph.D. Bill, are you there?
I am, Peter.
Well, Bill, I've gotten a chance to look at some of your videos, and they're lovely.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
They're lovely. Bill Ryan, this is what the editor of the Journal of Humanistic Psychology wrote about my guest. Bill writes with the eye of an artist and the heart of a healer. He's one of those wise and warm souls who seems to have brought out the best in those with whom he worked and drew upon the best to hone his craft. What I liked about his book, Working from the Heart, is that it articulates a vision that is in desperate need of revitalization today. This vision emphasizes heart perspicacity. God, I can't even say that word, and depth. Bill, like myself, has some videos up. You all know that I have this wonderful series called Simple Truths about psychiatry. It's well over 40,000 viewers now. We've just been so pleased with it, and I've finished filming another six to go along with those five, and we're going to be putting those up. One will be up in the next few weeks. Well, Bill Ryan has his own series of videos. One is called Love Blocks. Another is The Counsel, Working from the Heart. Another is Self-Forgiveness. And much to my profound envy, he plays the harp. He actually plays the harp while he makes some of the parts of his presentation. They're beautifully done presentations, really from the viewpoint of the therapist and how therapy works, but even more so, they're just about life and about overcoming our blocks to loving one another, something he and I are both very interested in. I really recommend, I don't usually heartily recommend competing things. Maybe they're not even competing, they're just supplementing each other. His videos go beautifully with my videos. You can get to his videos, Bill Ryan's videos, simply by Googling YouTube, William P. Ryan, Ph.D., and you'll get plopped right there. Hello, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well today, Peter. And thank you, because I do think of the complementarity of the videos. Yeah, so.
Yeah, it's really there. You come across with great warmth and understanding, and I found your concept of the council very interesting. Folks, that's an idea about making decisions by bringing together different aspects of yourself to, so that the whole self is making the decision. And I'll let Bill tell you more about that. Where would you like to begin, Dr. Ryan?
Well, we can jump in lots of different places, Peter. I think I'd like to tell the story that I told you when we were on the phone together for a few minutes yesterday, that why I'm doing this. At this point, I'm 71 and have been in practice, private practice, for almost 40 years. So you and I are in the same generation. And 7 or 8 years ago, I had a very aggressive cancer, a lymphoma, and I'm grateful for a good surgeon and good oncologist, and so I'm considered cured at this point. So I recovered from that. But in the aftermath, I gave a lot of thought to a deeper awareness of the preciousness of time, that it made me acutely aware that who knows how much time I had left, and what do I want to do with the time that I had, and who do I want to spend it with? And one of the powerful things that kept coming back into my mind over and over again was, I want to leave a legacy. I want to be able to pass on to the next generations of therapists what I've learned about effective psychotherapy that no one ever taught me, that I learned through the experience of doing the work. And so that led to a book coming out a couple of years ago, which I call Working from the Heart, A Therapist's Guide to Heart-Centered Psychotherapy. And a core part of that is an area that you and I, because I've read your excellent work also, The Heart of Being Helpful, and there are a lot of overlaps in that work, certainly. Those are certainly companion works. That most of us, and the most of the therapists that I've known, that when they first thought of entering this work, they thought of it, the motivation was a heartfelt one and a soul-felt one of a desire out of to help people who are suffering. And yet, most of us, when we were trained, the emphasis was upon theories and techniques and being a professional. And by professional, that was really meant being distant, being objective is the word they use, keeping and maintaining an emotional distance. And you and I both know that the opposite of that is really what's most important, is that our patients benefit from us being a compassionate, empathic presence, a source of loving kindness. And it's our acts of non-sexual, non-romantic love that are a powerful ingredient in the healing. And that it's not an extra, it's an essential core element in our patients getting better. That they, in a palpable way, know that we genuinely care about them. And it's not to say that the theories or the techniques and being a professional aren't important, but rather that we need a synthesis of our minds and our hearts, and that's how then our patients benefit from our most powerful kind of presence and how we can help them the most. And it's, you know, it's a paradoxical thing. Because, you know, all the research says when patients are asked, you know, what was the thing that was most helpful to you in your therapy? I mean, they don't say, my therapist was using this particular technique, or the theory he used was this, or she used, or that gave me this particular medication. They invariably say, he or she cared about me as a person. The most powerful healing element. And so what part of what I'm trying to do, as you are in your work, trying to get therapists to bring that compassionate presence, that open-hearted caring, into the work more, and to encourage folks to do that. And then there are certain areas that wherein the open-hearted presence and compassion of the therapist are essential, and the work doesn't get done without those. Even and so that open-heartedness is even more important. And you mentioned some of them. You mentioned the whole area of love blocks, the area of self-forgiveness, the area of the counsel, and maybe we can get into those further as we go along.
Well, let me say that I'm just so much in agreement with you. Folks, when I first started talking with Bill on the phone, and he brought up the caring issue, and I mean, some of you may know that early in my career, when I was doing psychotherapy, I asked the patients who were doing well how they were being helped. What was I doing that was helpful to them? And I set up sessions without a charge where I just wanted to interview them about what had been helping them. And I also called patients that I hadn't seen in a while that seemed to have had a successful therapy, some couples, asked them to come in and if they wouldn't mind and just talk to me about that. And I never wrote anything about this. This was a very personal thing for me, other than to mention this. I never wrote about it in any detail. And they all basically said, you cared about me so much, Peter, we learned to care about ourselves, or I learned to care about myself. And it wasn't they were disregarding, as Bill said, you know, some of what we learned about childhood or some of the insights or whatever, but it's definitely not what they were left with as what they were gaining and had gained. It was about that sense of being cared about and then caring about themselves, taking care of themselves, which was also caring about other people. It was that whole loving, caring package. Bill, one of your videos is about love blocks, and you've got a list of the things that blocks people from love. I don't expect you to necessarily go one by one through them, but it might be good to talk to folks about your perceptions on that.
Sure. Well, I think that one of the central goals of therapy is to get our, and I use the word patients. I know some people use the word clients, but I think they're interchangeable, but you always hear me say patients because that's how I was trained and that's what I feel most comfortable with. So, but I think that one of the core things that we need to be able to do in therapy is to get our patients back to a very simple and basic process of being able to simply easily give and receive love. Easily give and receive. And the area that I've found the most helpful working with is in the people, in our patients' blocks to receptivity. And I find that when people become more receptive to love, they naturally become more loving. And so I've evolved this term, love blocks, as a way of talking about these unconscious blocks that we have to being able to simply receive the love that's available to us in our lives. And there are some very very simple and common examples of these. How often that when people are given a compliment, how they're usually unable to easily simply take that in. How often that when people are, when you approach people with affection, how often they're easily unable, they're unable to easily simply receive that. How difficult it is for most people to receive help or ask for help. And yet, receiving help is one of the most basic forms of love. And how much difficulty people have in asking for and taking in people, others' offers of help. So these are a few of the love blocks. There are quite a number of them. In fact, it was interesting to me to read your book because at one point you made a comment. You said, you know, the people have difficulties in receiving love. somebody could probably write a whole book about that.
Yes.
And I remember, I just laughed when I read that line in your book, because I did write a whole book about that 20 years ago called Love Locks. I co-authored it with a woman named Mary Ellen Donovan, and it's a whole chapter in my book.
I don't know that, and on this show, Bill, I've gone into a lot of length about this issue. I bring up love probably every show one way or another, but about what keeps people from loving. And I think it would be interesting to explore that. Certainly one of the greatest things that keeps people from bearing love to love is having been dreadfully hurt in that regard.
Mm.
In infancy or childhood by having love not given freely, or losing love. And I know I was in love when I was 16, and when I was 19, I felt very much in love when I was 16. And then again when I was 19 or 20, and I got rejected, and I got so hurt, I never dared love. And again, really fully until my 40s, when God got fed up with me and Ginger not being together and just slapped us together and said, "Do it, for God's sake." It's like,
divine intervention.
I was so hurt and Ginger was so hurt, we could barely do it on our own.
Mm.
So I think that's one of the huge things, and people even forget that they loved somebody when they were 16 or 19 or 35 and got hurt.
Well, I have three grandchildren right now. Do you have some, Peter?
Yes, just spent Thanksgiving with two grandkids.
So I think when you watch little ones at very young age, they're very receptive to love. They're what I call love machines. They're very receptive to, and they give it very easily. So then what we need to do is begin to look back on how did these unconscious patterns develop, where that ordinary receptive self, which is part of our humanity, got warded off, that we block it. And it's an interesting thing. See, it's one of the reasons why it's important for us to have a more open-hearted presence and an open-hearted way of being as a therapist, rather than the objective, distant professional. Because when you express simple acts of forms of love in the office setting, in our relationship, then you see how the love blocks start to emerge. So, for example, if I compliment one of my patients, then I see how difficult they have in receiving that. When I start to encourage them, when I'm warm towards them, when I celebrate a moment of growth, each of these times and lots of other times when I are loving in some way towards my patients, you can see their difficulty in receiving it. And so then I say, Well, what happened to you in your life that makes it so difficult for you to receive what I'm offering to you right now? And I'm talking, again, it's not sexual love or romantic love. It's simple acts of loving kindness and being a loving presence. So then we begin to explore that. And so you see situations, for example, where people have been physically abused or sexually violated. And they have tremendous difficulty then, because of these earlier experiences, in being receptive to warm physical contact. When I compliment patients and they have trouble receiving it, they oftentimes say to me, "Well, you don't really know me. If you really got to know me, you would never think that of me." And then I sought to look into their childhood with them and see that they oftentimes grew up in very judgmental, hypercritical families. And so they have this internalized feeling, I'm not worthy of love. I'm not deserving of it. And my parents, they were people who really knew me. Other people don't know me. And if they once they and if, In fact, that's one of the reasons why I don't be so intimate with people, let them inside of me, because if they really get close to me, they'll find out what a horrible person I am. So these difficulties in receptivity emerge as part of the exchange that occurs in our relationship. And these are like very precious kinds of moments.
I really do agree with you about that. I can think of times when my patients or clients have looked at me and said, nobody's ever cared about me, or nobody will care about me. And I sort of look and I wave my hand. They say, whoa, here I am.
Uh-huh.
And then they have to struggle with that. But here's this person waving his hand with a cute smile on his face saying, yeah, listen, you've known me a while. I care about what happens to you. And then often from that, I find that I can then talk about other people who have also cared about this individual, but who might have been lost, or whose caring has gotten all tangled up in all these emotional issues.
Mm.
But you can remind people that they've been cared about indeed, but there may have been pain around it.
Mm, a lot of pain around it. And so what happens is that they start to ward it off and be less receptive to when people are loving, or don't believe they deserve it, or like some patients I have, I use the phrase that they feel like love is for other people, but it's not in the cards for me. Or like,
yes.
And how I got involved in this whole area myself is in my own work on myself. I realized that I was only receptive to love if people did it in a certain kind of way. And they had to do it in a way that made me feel like I was special to them. And other than that, I diminished whatever people did or said that was loving, unless they connoted in what they were saying that I was a special human being to them.
Yeah.
And I had to look back and how that related to some childhood experiences where I wasn't made to feel special, and that was that still yearning of a childhood wish. And once I worked through that, then I became much more receptive. So that was another love block that I talk with patients about. I want love, but only if it's in a certain way.
Yeah, and it, particularly it has to be there whether I'm nice or not.
Uh-huh, right.
Whether I've asked for it or not.
Uh-huh.
In fact, it should have been volunteered before I ever asked for it.
Mm.
And a lot of that is the understandable wish to just be embraced like the child again. And the interesting thing is that when we do have a really mature adult relationship, we actually can get embraced like a child again. We can be held and loved, and we can be healed. Even the hurt child inside can get healed. People think, oh, the hole can never be filled. It can be. But first you have to open your heart to it, as you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to find somebody to do it with, who shares with you that they want that kind of a love that really heals, that's wonderful, and that has a deep spiritual aspect to it.
Mm-hmm.
But people do doubt it, don't they?
Oh, they very much doubt it, sure. And, I mean, I know for myself that with the relationship with my wife, Jean, that we've been together now over 20 years, and I know it's healed a lot of the old wounds for me. But first I had to kind of, and I help my patients do, is let go of some of the love blocks that were in the way of being receptive.
Yeah. Yeah, for me it was sheer terror. Not to mention anticipation of overwhelming depression.
Uh-huh.
People mean a lot to each other, and it's, you know, one of the things we want to hide from is, because it's potentially so painful, how much other people really do mean to us. And for some people, it's a wide extended family. For others, it's that one person that makes all the difference in the world. People approach love in different ways, but it's universal that human beings mean a lot to each other, And that's scary, and that confronts us with the existential issues, too, you know, of losing losing loved ones. And were you married? I guess you were married during this time when you developed that cancer.
Mm, yes. Uh-huh.
That must have scared the heck out of your wife.
Yeah, well, it was terrifying for her. In fact,
yeah.
One of the things that came from that, it was a very deep understanding that it wasn't I who was having cancer, it was we who were having cancer.
Yeah.
And it was really a very helpful thing to me. It's interesting how things evolve in our kind of work, is that how the life experiences that we have deepen our compassion. And I oftentimes think about that anything that happens to in a life that deepens our compassion is a good thing. And so one of the things that happened for me with that experience was it helped me to really have a larger amount of empathy for people going through serious illness or for people who had to deal with death. Or death issues, or the fear of dying, and also how it affected their partners. So that my experience with my wife Jean about we having cancer helped me to know I need to help with my patients to understand that it's important for them to open up about what they're experiencing and be open to that their partner, if you're having a serious illness, your partner is also terrified. They're going through their own process, and we need to talk about that together, because it's a we. It's a we.
Yeah, very, very much so. Life is a we.
Uh-huh.
When you have a loved one, life is a we. I've never spoken that sentence before, but it seems to capture a lot of what we're talking about. That love really, you know, to me, love is the one experience that does away with the concept of competition and self-interest, because when you love another, their happiness matters to you the way your own does, sometimes even more. People commonly sacrifice their happiness for loved ones or even their lives for loved ones. So we were very familiar with that in regard to parents and their children, of course, but I think it happens on all levels of relationship. And so it really, life really becomes a we. It becomes a shared experience. And I've been married 30 years now, and with Ginger, and we look back and we look forward in terms of this evolving we that is taking place sometimes in amazing ways.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
When did you start to think in terms of love being so central to you, to life?
That's a difficult question to answer. I think a simpler, you flummox. Oftentimes
you
get
can't be quiet,
like
on radio. Somebody's got to speak.
Yeah, exactly. I think the best way to really talk about it because I'm thinking about it in terms of the process of therapy, is how my patients were helped more through my various ways of being loving. And that, one of the early examples of that would be when I first started to disclose with clients, with my patients, that I came from an alcoholic home. That moment of intimacy with those patients who came from that background was a loving act to take the risk to share something of which I was ashamed, to make an empathic connection with them. And it showed me how, as therapists, the act our self-disclosure and telling aspects of our own story and the things that we've struggled with is one of the more powerful acts of love in our therapeutic relationship. And how that impacts upon them, that they feel like they're in the presence of a fellow human being, not just someone who's this professional who has, who's at a higher level than me, but now making a human-to-human contact. And so our hearts are touching each other as I share some aspects of my own journey with you.
I'm talking with William P. Ryan. We're going to go to break. Dr. Ryan, you can find out all about him and especially his videos by just going to YouTube, William P. Ryan. We'll go to break as the music starts and be back in a couple of minutes. And this is Peter Regan. I'm talking with Bill Ryan, William P. Ryan is the way to find him on the web. Bill, how can people get in touch with you? Do you are still seeing patients? How can they find you?
You could put williampryan.com, and you'll come to my website, and then there's a way of contacting me through that.
Where are you? What city
yeah, so
are you
I'm
in here?
At this point, I live in a small town in the western part of Massachusetts, a small town called Ashfield, and my practice is in a town called Shelburne Falls, where I practice part-time at this point in my life. Most of my years of practice were in suburban Long Island in a town called Huntington.
I grew up in Long Island, left there when I went off to Harvard. Did you grow up there?
No, actually, I was born in Brooklyn and lived there until I was 9, and then did most of my growing up on Staten Island, one of the other boroughs of the city of New York.
Yeah. We both live in small towns. We both love nature. We both have a lot of very similar views on relationship. Golly, I'm enjoying just talking about the love issues. Maybe you could connect your counsel approach that you have at times to helping people with the issues of love. You want to give a try at that?
Oh, certainly. Well, at some point in most people's therapy, that they have, and sometimes people begin therapy with this, and sometimes it just shows up in the process, is that they have some major life dilemma. They have some major life issue that they need to resolve. And there's a wide spectrum of those in terms of relationships, in terms of job issues, and moving, all kinds of things, a wide spectrum. And what I say to people at that time is when they talk with me about the major conflict, the major dilemma, I say to them, that dilemma cannot be resolved at the level of consciousness at which it exists. And what happens is when people are faced with these kind of dilemmas, what they try to do is they try to resolve it from some rational, cognitive level. And those resolutions are always inadequate. So what they do is they make lists of pros and cons and pluses and minuses and et cetera. So it remains at a certain realm of rationality and cognition, trying to come up with a resolution. And what it does is produces a tremendous amount of tension and not a resolution that's in the best interest of the of the overall personality. And so what I've evolved is a technique which I call the counsel, which engages the heart and higher realms of consciousness in working with a dilemma. So these major crises come from different parts of your personality are in conflict. And what we want to do from a place of compassion towards yourself and compassionate love towards all the fiery parts of you is get, instead of having the parts of the personality work against each other, have the parts of the personality work together. And so I suggest to them what we're going to do is we're going to have for a period of time what I call a council, that the various parts of your personality are going to gather for a period of time in this office. And I also encourage them to think of some other gathering place, a metaphorical gathering place, usually it's in nature. And the parts of the personality are going to meet, and one of the parts of the personality is the wise elder. And the wise elder represents your deep knowing about what's best for you. It holds the question of what's in the best interest of my total personality about this dilemma at this time of life. And the wise elder, because it has a very big heart, that is compassionate towards all the different parts of the personality and will honor and respect and treat them with dignity as you go through this conflict of trying to get the parts of the personality to work together. And so, and I describe this in much more detail than we have the time for today on the site, the YouTube site, and in my book. And well, so what happens over a period of time...
Now, are you not talking about like a stereotypes of the wise elder, something Jungian, but something that comes out of the person's personality?
Yeah,
or both?
It's something that really comes out from what I refer to as the higher self. Or what, if you were in recovery, you would call the personal higher power. That higher level of consciousness is taking the dilemma to another realm. So it's going to resolve it from a higher level of consciousness. And it's going to do it with deep compassion and allow a process to unfold that honors all the different parts of the personality as making some contribution to the resolution.
How do people get to these aspects of themselves?
That's what the council is designed to do. That's the purpose of that. So the way I say to people is that each of the different thoughts and opinions you have about this crisis, each one comes from a part of your personality. And so I'll give you a relatively quick example. I had a patient of mine who was a coach, and he was a very high-level track coach, and he was offered the dream of a lifetime, except the dream of a lifetime job at a major, one of the top universities in the country, would mean that he had to move out of the area geographically where he was the father, had gone through a divorce, where he would be separated from his children. So the dilemma, the dream of a lifetime, time with my children, what do I do? So he had one part of his personality was the father. Another part of his personality was the coach who had this dream. Another part of his personality was the perfectionist who always wanted to do the right thing and was very critical. Another part of him was the financial part of him. Another part of him was, and this is part of every counsel, another part of him was simply fear. And so we got all these parts to work together and talk about their various aspects of in greater depth over a period of time till he came to a resolution that worked for the totality of his personality.
Now, is he actually talking as one part or another?
Mm-hmm.
When he's in the therapy?
So if you can imagine the therapy...
I want this to be vivid so we can get what's going on.
Sure. So if you imagine the therapy space, and what I do, and if you watch the video, you'll see my hands move around when I describe this patient. So I say, okay, so that part of your personality is sitting over there. and this other part is sitting over there, and this other part is sitting over here, and that part is sitting over there, and that part is sitting over there. Okay, so what does the father have to say? What does the interior critic have to say? What does the child part of you have to say? What does the part of you that's terrified have to say? What does the person who has a lifetime dream, what do they all have to say?
Now, in the coach's case, mm-hmm. what happened?
Mm-hmm. So what happened was the resolution that came to him was that he decided not to take that job because of the children, but also that he applied for a job as a somebody who coached for the Olympic team, so that he could still, and the introductory level of people who were trained for the Olympics, and so he was able to stay within the geographic area with his children, but then he could fly to this training site, and then come back and be with his children, and live in that same geographical area, and so he got another version of the dream of a lifetime, and still had the time with his children. And he had never thought of that resolution before, and that's how it got resolved through the meeting of the council in the office. And when I do this with people, I think I get them to talk about a metaphor. Like, so we're going to have the meeting in the office, but also metaphorically that this meeting is going to go on outside the office. And where do you I help them to create a space in which this can occur. And so, like, for me, whenever I do a council, the space that I imagine this occur, because I'm a nature-oriented person, is around a fire in the woods. And other people think of other nature settings, so they think of, like, a number of chairs by the ocean, and they're sitting around discussing this. When he did this, and I say to people, okay, so where do you think you would have this kind of council? He said, in a locker room. And I'll imagine, like, all the different parts of my personality are like players on the team. And it worked well.
Was he able to have a loving self in the locker room?
Yes, exactly. He was able to do that, yeah. Because that's the kind of coach he was.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Was renowned for that. Hmm.
Talk some more about your practice over the years in terms of your the burnout issues and... you know, from my experience, if you're in touch the way you're describing with caring about people, you're going to enjoy them a lot, even though there'll be crises and problems and issues and scary things in therapy. But there isn't any burnout if you're really caring about your patients, respecting them, enjoying them, that there's no more burnout on that than there is on friendship. It just can be a little more difficult at times than friendship, but also even safer than friendship because it has limits.
I
find myself still enjoying therapy after all these years, and my gosh, I've been involved since I was a college student working with patients in a state mental hospital as a volunteer.
I agree with you, Peter. I have the same feeling about the work that I, even after doing it for almost 40 years. And I've come to understand some aspects of what really enables me to do that. And you probably have your own versions of that. See, I think it's a very hard thing to do to be in the energy field of so much pain and suffering, hour after hour, day after day, for years. I think that's a very difficult thing. And that oftentimes, in response to that, therapists become emotionally distant as a self-protective thing. They become tired and depleted. They become sometimes numbed, sometimes resentful of patients.
And they start sending them to psychiatrists for drugs. They get so resentful and feel so hopeless.
Yeah. So how do you not do that? How do you maintain an optimal sense of compassionate, empathic presence hour after hour, day after day? And I think of like a couple of things have really helped me with that. And one is outside of sessions, and one is inside of sessions. Outside of sessions, I think generally therapists are not good at taking care of themselves. And so I talk about the whole area, which I call recharging, is that the psychological, physical, spiritual batteries of most therapists are very depleted because they don't take good care of themselves. And so we need to find out, why do we have such a problem taking care of ourselves? And we don't have the time to go into that, but I do that on the site more. And then I recommend for people ways of recharging that can work well for them. But what I want to talk about today, I think the most in the time we have left, is how do you recharge yourself? How do you become that, be continually that presence right in while you're in the session? And what's helpful to me about this over the long time is to think about that there's a part of my consciousness that has a bigger heart than my ordinary heart. If I was just relying on the ordinary heart of everyday consciousness, I think I would just feel overwhelmed and depleted and numbed, which I never do. And so what I think about is that my heart, I have part of my consciousness, which is an aspect of my higher self, that has a larger heart, has a great capacity to be in the presence of large pain and suffering. And I need to be able to connect to that big heart during a session. And so I have an image in my office, I'll tell you a story that just happened to a patient today about this. It's very interesting and synchronistic. So I think of my wise heart, because I encourage patients, and I encourage the patients of mine who are therapists to develop a personal relationship with their higher self. And so in my office, I have a wooden carving of a head of an old man that's from a second growth redwood that my wife Jean gave me a number of years back. And I think of it that this is, I call my higher self wise heart, that it has this big heart and it contains a lot of heart wisdom. And so whenever I'm in the energy field of a lot of sadness, of hopelessness, of despair, a lot of anxiety, I look over at that carving and I think of that aspect of my consciousness has a much bigger heart, and I need to open to that at this moment, so I don't shut down and become depleted by the bigness of the feelings that I'm in. So what I do is I look at that image and think of that big, much larger heart, and then I breathe. I do a little bit of meditational breathing.
It's so interesting how each of us finds a way. I think I do almost exactly the same thing, but I do it in a more perhaps conventionally spiritual way. I remind myself that I'm a being, that I'm a soul, and my client, my patient is a soul, that we're part of something greater, and that we're really immersed in a spiritual universe. And sometimes I would think about God, that there's a loving God, and get in touch with that sense of a loving spiritual universe. And I think we're both going in exactly the same direction. It sounds like I'm just a little bit more, seeing it as participation of God in our lives.
Well, as an extension of what I just said, I also think of, I think of that part of my consciousness, wise heart, as a channel for expressing divine love.
You do think that way.
I do think of that way. I oftentimes.
Well, I'm glad I brought it up.
Yeah, I think of it as.
People are too shy about just saying that.
Go ahead. Yeah, right. That I think of that my higher self is my inner divine, and I'm developing a personal relationship with that. So I can connect with it when I need it, and I need it most when I'm with patients, and that part of myself is a conduit or a vehicle or a channel of divine love. Yeah, and so let me share, because we in the time we have left, you probably experience the same thing as me. As I'm getting older, I have greater and greater respect for the things that we cannot explain that are mysterious. And one of those mysterious processes is synchronicity. So I knew I was going to be talking with you today. And I wanted to talk about this whole thing about the big heart. So I have a patient of mine who lives on Long Island. And I saw him originally a number of years ago when I was practicing there. And then he recontacted me. And we now have phone sessions. So he's a therapist. And so he was talking with me. He said, you know, Bill, I was talking with a patient of mine just yesterday, and I remembered about what you had said about our big hearts. And he said, this patient is the mother of a teenager who committed suicide. And even as I'm talking with you about that, I feel like goosebumps all over my body, like how much difficult it is as a therapist to be in the presence of that much suffering. And he said, I found myself doing an amazing thing. I found that as I was talking with the client, I felt my hands move in my right and left hand move together in the shape of a heart.
Mm.
And that reminded me that I have this bigger heart. And if I stay in touch with that bigger heart that my hands are gesturing as a symbol of, that I will be able to be with her in the way that she needs me to be with her.
Yeah.
Wow. And that happened, you know, that's an example of the synchronicity that happened the day while we were going to talk about this. Wow.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating universe that we live in.
It is. And I agree with you that the older I get, the more I appreciate the unknowable, accept it, feel a part of it in a way, feel that we're all a part of it. Well, it's got only about 3 or 4 minutes left. Just reminding folks, my guest is William P. Ryan, PhD. You can Google him, William P. Ryan, and you'll find his really well done videos. Did you have a professional or a family friend do these videos? You do them yourself?
No, I had
really nicely done.
I had a professional do it, yes. We worked 6 months on those videos.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Yeah, we worked 6 months on. We wanted to create the sense of, so people could have a sense of who I am as a person and what it would like to be with me. And he did an excellent job of it. And it's professional without being slick.
Yes, it was. It was exactly that. It's funny. My own style is, you know, my friend Jackie is a photographer. She doesn't do a lot of this kind of work, but she comes over and I do 6 little talks and she packages them for me. And I've done that twice now. She was over just a couple of weeks ago and I look at her and I love her, and I sit in front of the background of my windows looking out on Cayuga Lake, and I chat away, and then we package it up.
Can you tell me what the name of that is? Because I haven't seen those, and I want to.
Well, they're Simple Truths About Psychiatry. You can just get them off my website, where you'll see Simple Truths on the listed among at the top of the page. But you can also just go to Bregan, Google Breggin videos or Breggin Simple Truths About Psychiatry, and you'll get there.
Okay, good, good. Thank you.
Any last thoughts from your 71 years on Earth, with at least, I'm hoping, 30 more for myself? That'll make me 108 or something. And by that time, Ginger will be so old, we'll both be really old together, even though she's younger than me. It really is a we. Love creates a we. Further thoughts as we draw near an end.
Yeah, I think that even though it makes us feel more vulnerable, I think one of the best things that we can do for our patients and for ourselves is to be more open-hearted in the work, to allow ourselves the vulnerability of opening our hearts more, to be more expressive of that, and so that our patients can palpably feel that kind of presence. And that's a scary thing to do, you know, because there is a vulnerability in that. And yet it makes it more not simply a professional with a client. It makes it a professional and a caring, loving human being together. Wow.
That's a perfect, perfect ending. William P. Ryan, Dr. Ryan, Therapist Ryan, thank you very, very much for being on the Peter Breggin Hour with me. Thank you.
I'm very grateful for you, to you for giving me the opportunity to share my ideas. Thank you so much, too, Peter. And what I do is I'll send you a big hug.
Okay. I receive it and return it. A big hug. And to our audience, a big hug.